Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's 8:06 on this Monday, May 4th. 47 degrees currently in Old Town Park City under partly cloudy skies. We've got 49 degrees at the Heber Valley Airport, again with a few clouds. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Monday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Monday. We're looking at a mixture of clouds and sunshine as we go throughout today. There is a little moisture that's going to be creeping in from south to north across the area, so that's going to give us at least the chance of a few isolated showers and thunderstorms popping up this afternoon into the early evening hours. Now, don't expect a washout. Don't expect a ton of rainfall. No severe weather expected, but there will be a chance of a few hit-or-miss showers and a couple of rumbles of thunder as we go throughout this afternoon and evening. High temperatures in Park City climb to around the low 60s. The Heber Valley, we're looking at high temperatures around 70 degrees. As we go into your Tuesday, look for another chance of those scattered showers and storms coming through the area. This time we'll see that moisture moving from north to south across the area, so the better chance will likely be earlier in the afternoon hours to see those pop-up showers and storms. Again, not a washout expected, but a chance of some isolated to scattered showers and storms as we go throughout your Tuesday. High temperatures in Park City will climb to the upper 50s to near 60. Meanwhile, highs will climb into the mid-60s in the Heber Valley. Once we get you towards your Wednesday, a ridge of high pressure starts to settle in from the west. This high pressure will start to bring drier and warmer conditions to the area. Now, as we go throughout your Wednesday, we'll keep things into the upper 50s to near 60 with some sunshine in Park City for a high. We'll see those highs in the low 60s in the Heber Valley. By the time we get towards your Thursday, look for lots of sunshine. Temperatures climbing into the upper 60s in Park City. We'll see those highs climbing into the low 70s in the Heber Valley. We're not done warming up yet. Park City, by the time we get towards your Friday, look for high temperatures climbing to around the 70-degree mark, and we'll see those highs well into the mid-70s in the Heber Valley. We'll stick with highs in the mid to upper 60s in Park City heading into your Mother's Day weekend with highs in the mid-70s in the Heber Valley. We'll call it a mixture of sun and clouds, but looking pretty good. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back on ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned. Coming up, we'll be checking in with Summit County Sheriff Spokesperson Skylar Talbot. Later on, Heber City Manager Matt Brower previewing Tuesday's City Council meeting. And finally, from YMCA, we'll be talking with both the overnight and day camp managers, Callie Gernicki and Ashley Bailu, with details on this summer's camp programs. Registration is underway for these two Summit County camps. Construction on a mixed-use path along Little Kate Road in Park City will not move forward this summer. KPCW's Gavin McGuff reports the council delayed the project over concerns from neighborhood residents.
From the rail trail to Poison Creek to McLeod, mixed-use pathways are well known to Parkites. But plans to put a similar path along Little Kate Road in Park Meadows have met with significant opposition. The Park City Council heard over an hour of public comment on the project at its April 30th meeting. Nearly all opposed mixing pedestrian and bike traffic on the trail. Resident Hong McDonald tells the council safety is the neighborhood's primary concern.
This is the Park Meadows residents that I was talking about. These are the users. You can put together a plan for people who don't live there, but the people who do showed up today, and we have more that couldn't be here today. And safety is one of the biggest concerns.
The proposed trail is an offshoot of an ongoing project to upgrade bus stops in Park City. During those efforts, staff began to consider safety improvements along a busy stretch of roadway between the McPolin Elementary School and the PC Mark. The project is largely paid for by a $2.2 million grant from the Federal Transit Administration. The current design proposes replacing bike lanes and a sidewalk with a 12-foot-wide paved mixed-use pathway. During a work session presentation, City Transportation Planner Anna Mackey recognized they have heard resident concerns.
But based on the current usage levels, we would expect the space to function comfortably. National guidance indicates that a 12-foot pathway can accommodate up to 150 people per hour. That's both walking and biking while maintaining that comfort and safety.
According to city data, usage along Little Kate Road peaks at 39 people per hour. Poison Creek and the rail trail can see average peaks between 100 and 125. The design at Little Kate is based on the same standards accepted elsewhere in the city and country, says city engineer John Robertson. If council rejects the plan, the city's overall approach to pathway design would need to be revisited.
We need to really have a good discussion with you and folks so we don't come down to this point again to where we get this proposal before you and it's council and residents come and say, we don't like this, but well, this is a multi-use path with accepted in many places throughout the states. So if we want something different here, we need to work with you, work with the groups to start really putting something together that's going to be doable and constructible for everybody.
Staff hoped council would be ready to vote on a construction contract by May 7th, but they agreed to pause after council members expressed concerns over e-bike use and the safety of elementary school students walking to class. Council member Tana Tolley says she felt staff was rushing a decision.
You guys know that this was a very heated topic in this community, and to give us sort of a yes or no today without even like, hey, we could come back in a couple weeks with some other ideas, it's not sitting well with me. Like, I feel very put on the spot right now.
Staff will go back to the drawing board and present an updated plan for the pathway with further separation between bikers and pedestrians along the route. Council will discuss those plans on May 7th, but the city will not break ground on the bikeway project this summer. Instead, it will begin upgrades to bus stops along the route while work continues on a pathway plan. Gavin McGough, KPCW News.
In the studio now with an update from the Summit County Sheriff's Office, I have Public Information Officer Skylar Talbot. Good morning, Skylar.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Doing great. So let's start with ICE, the Immigration Custom Enforcement Agents being in town last week. How is the Summit County Sheriff's Office involved, if at all?
We did have ICE operating in the county last week, as you know, and, you know, we saw several stories going around about it. Nothing really has changed on the part of the sheriff's office. You know, we've been saying since the beginning, we're, you know, our mission is public safety. That's what it will continue to be. Not a lot changes. It's interesting. We still have law enforcement, our own law enforcement operations taking place around the county. So we do sometimes see our own operations getting lumped into ICE operations, which can sometimes be problematic, right? I get it. The community is concerned and rightfully so. But, you know, for example, I think we had three completely separate, I believe two search warrants that were taking place in coordination with the Utah Attorney General's office. They were child predator warrants. And, you know, so we're out doing this law enforcement operation, and then it sort of gets lumped in and labeled as an ICE operation. So, immigration enforcement's happening. The sheriff's office, we're not in the business of immigration enforcement, but we are still out, you know, doing our own enforcement. So, you're going to see sheriff's deputies out. We're in unmarked cars as well, but just because you see an unmarked police car doesn't necessarily mean it's an ICE operation.
All right, but the sheriff's office doesn't get any kind of warning from ICE, huh?
So typically, you know, we have our standing agreement with the local agents that they will inform dispatch when they intend to operate in the county. Usually it's a simple phone call to dispatch, hey, we're going to be, you know, doing a targeted operation in Summit County. That's the, you know, the gist of it. They don't give us details. We don't ask details. And then when they leave, when they've concluded that operation, they'll call us back, let us know that they're done. And, you know, really, and like we've said in the past, the reason for that is just to, you know, avoid these blue-on-blue situations and really de-conflict is the main priority there.
Yeah, but they don't give you any briefing or debriefing on this.
They do not, no.
Yeah, so we don't know how many people were rounded up Wednesday, and with the exception of this 22-year-old kid who grew up in Park City, really no one's talking about the others. So what sort of protection do ICE officers have? I mean, just in terms of, you know, they don't talk to the media. Apparently they don't need to release names or reasons for detaining someone.
Yeah, you know, I don't want to speak on behalf of ICE or the federal government. As far as the sheriff's office involvement, it's very limited. They let us know when they're going to be here. They let us know when they leave, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, Wednesday's roundup was what was called a targeted operation, meaning that they are looking for specific people. Now, this Pacheco kid had applied for DACA. That's the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. His application had been paused because of the number of applications filed. His attorney says the worst thing he's done is a traffic violation. So any idea where why he might be targeted?
You know, I don't. Again, I don't want to speak on behalf of the federal government, you know, and their operations or investigations. I don't know anything about, you know, why he was detained. I don't have any details on that.
Yeah, and we understand that he was taken to Wyoming. Why not stay in Utah? Does Salt Lake not have any of these holding cells?
Yeah, again, I don't know. I know that there is a facility in Salt Lake, you know, as far as the logistical reasons behind, you know, why who goes where, I wouldn't know anything about that.
Hmm. And the family, I mean, what can they do? Anything? I mean, does he go to court? Does he have a hearing or...
I mean, I would assume so, but again, this is you know, outside my realm of responsibility. Again, when it comes to ICE and the sheriff's office, public safety is our mission, and will continue to be our mission. So, you know, to the extent you know, we can help folks feel safe in our community, that's what we want, right? We you know, safer community is what we are after. But as far as what ICE is doing, why they're doing it, and again, those logistical reasons, that's something that I'm just not aware of.
Okay. Moving on, what can you tell me about the Summit County Attorney's Office investigation of Wasatch County Sheriff Jared Rigbig?
Well, I'm for obvious reasons, not authorized to speak to that too much. I can tell you, you know, we're obviously aware of the recent media reportings, and, you know, the attorney's office has sent out, I believe now, two statements to media. I'm certainly happy to get you those written statements, but that would be the extent of what I'll get into today.
Yeah. So does the attorney's office have its own investigators, or is this something that they're going to rely on the sheriff's department to investigate?
The attorney's office does have an investigative arm with law enforcement officers that do act as their investigators.
Okay. Let's see. We recently saw a video that was posted by Salt Lake City Police of how they got a call reporting a stolen cell phone, immediately sent up a drone, and then found the guy. I don't know if it was staged or not, but are drones being used to fight crime in Summit County?
They are, yeah. We do have a fairly robust drone program right now. And yeah, you know, as you mentioned, these can be used to respond to crimes in progress, like this theft that you mentioned. Also very useful for, you know, lost children. We utilize them a lot, you know, on the search and rescue front as well. Interesting enough, though, we are actually in the process of starting our own drone as first responder program. Essentially what that entails is you know, having a drone stationary, and I don't know where it's going to be, likely somewhere in the Kimball Junction area. And then, yeah, like you mentioned, we get a report of a crime in progress, you know, be it an assault, a theft, whatever. We're able to immediately launch that drone. The drone can get there much quicker than a deputy, get eyes on, you know, eyes on that incident and start feeding real-time information.
Yeah. So who flies the drones? I mean, do you have officer deputies who are certified?
We do, yeah. So I believe now we have somewhere in the area of 7 to 10 deputies who are certified through the FAA to pilot our drones.
All right. And again, you can be at the Justice Center directing that drone?
Yeah, you know, really anywhere. You could be on the beach in Florida and flying a drone over Kimball Junction. So again, you know, the speed and efficiency is going to be just immense, and it's really going to help us, you know, prioritize those high-risk calls while staying responsive across the community.
Yeah. And there's some concern that drones used to fight crime may violate a person's Fourth Amendment. Basically, a warrantless surveillance, as we know, is unconstitutional.
You're right, and you know there are privacy concerns with any sort of new technology. I think it's important to focus on, you know, the idea that our drones, you know, we're utilizing them for targeted public safety. This isn't, you know, everyday monitoring, everyday just random surveillance. We're using our drones for specific calls, you know, again, realizing that there are those concerns, we intend to be open about how we're using the technology, and the community certainly can expect clear rules and responsible use every time.
Okay. Weather warming up, we've got more people headed out to the trails, people parking at the trailheads, and this is something we see every year with an increased number of vehicle break-ins. What do people need to know about that?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a great time just to sort of put a plug in and another warning like we do every year. These vehicle burgs, it's really just a crime of opportunity. So if it's visible, it's vulnerable. Folks need to get into the habit, if they're visiting the trails, take everything with you. If you're leaving your purse or, your laptop, your wallet, whatever, if that's in plain sight, you're really just asking for someone to either break a window or, try and get in and take that. So, again, take it with you, lock it up, call us, obviously, if you see someone suspicious in these trailheads, because they're likely just waiting for someone to leave something behind.
Yeah, and we've seen, not just people kind of walking around checking, whether or not a door is locked. We've actually seen kind of smash and grab, so, yeah.
Yeah, you see both, and, certainly lock your car, but that may not stop someone, right? So if the car's locked but you're still leaving valuables in there, well, you might come back to a smashed out window and a stolen purse.
All right. Let's see. When somebody, leaves the garage door open, off, also another crime of opportunity, people can go in and take, mountain bikes, electric bikes worth, thousands of dollars. What happens with that? When somebody gives the sheriff's department a report of a lost item, does that go into some big database, or how does that work?
It does, yes. So anytime someone reports stolen property, our deputies will take a stolen property report. In the context of that report, they are going to get all, any available information. So whether that's a serial number, whether that's, a photograph of the bike, whatever they can, that then gets logged in our local database of property. So if we do come across it, either by means of, in the course of an investigation, we've seen sometimes bikes be stolen and then they end up on like Facebook Marketplace or something like that. So by us taking that report, logging, those serial numbers or whatever it is, oftentimes we are able, if we locate the bike, to get it back to its owner.
Yeah. I know Park City Police Department offers a service to its residents that it will take the information prior to, give you a little sticker for your bike, that it has been registered with them. Does the sheriff's office do anything like that?
We currently don't have a program like that set up. It's a great idea, and certainly if, that's something that the community is interested in, I don't see any reason why the sheriff's office wouldn't be willing to, get a program like that in place. Again, if we can store, be it a serial number or some sort of other identifying, piece of information, again, we're able to get these this property back to its owners much more easily.
Okay, and as we heard with Park City Council, they have banned open fires and fireworks through the end of October. And I know that Park City Fire District working with Summit County to do what?
Yeah, so I know that the Park City Fire District has had a few conversations with Sheriff Bates about some of these fire restrictions going into place a lot earlier than we've seen them in the past. So I don't know that anything's been put into place, at the county level, but certainly people can expect those restrictions to go into place much earlier than we've seen in the past. And the sheriff's office, again, will be enforcing those restrictions earlier than we've seen.
All right. Skylar, anything else?
No, I probably won't see you before Mother's Day, so happy Mother's Day to all of our mothers out there.
Okay, Skylar, thank you. At Summit County Sheriff's Office, Public Information Officer Skylar Talbot. The Heber City Council meets on Tuesday starting at 6 o'clock. On the phone with a preview of the meeting, I have City Manager Matt Brower. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's start first with next year's budget. The council takes its first look at fiscal year 27's proposed budget on Tuesday. How big of a budget is it?
The fiscal year 27 budget is a $72 million budget.
Okay, and what kind of growth is that from the current year budget?
Current year budget is $87 million, so it's actually a decline. The primary reason for the decline is we wrapped up most of our capital projects that were under construction last year, so you're seeing that decline in the next year budget.
Mm-hmm. Now, the agenda includes a notice that the city may raise taxes. How much of a tax increase are you talking about?
It's a 5% increase to the certified tax rate. During the legislative session this past March, the state legislature passed, I think it was House Bill 236, mm-hmm. Which now requires cities to essentially, when the tentative budget is presented to the council before or at the first regular meeting in May, they have to essentially signal whether a tax increase is included or not. The budget officer has included a tax increase. As I mentioned, it's a 5% increase to certified tax rate, which generates about $174,000 of new tax revenue. The impact to an average home of $850,000 value is about, if I remember correctly, $20 a year and about just about $1.50 per month.
All right. So why, I mean, if you've got a decreasing budget, why would you need to raise taxes 5%?
Remember, we have 27 funds. One of those funds, the general fund, and the general fund is the one that would be increasing the taxes. So the other 26 funds are not involved. And so the $72 million total all funds budget includes all those funds. What we're talking about with the tax increase is specifically the general fund. And the primary reason for advocating for a tax increase at this time is over the last 5 years, we've seen significant inflationary pressures. Now, admittedly, the last few years, they've not been as great as they were 4 or 5 years ago. But from an aggregate perspective, the last 5 years, we've seen 22% increase in inflation. And the city has seen, more specifically, with construction material cost increases up to 20% in a single year. So this is about trying to offset inflationary impacts.
So, as you mentioned, House Bill 236 requires local governments to announce these tax increases sooner. You've said that this would create a lot more work for the finance department. How does this new law change Heber City's budgeting process?
Well, typically in the past, if the city was going to go through a tax increase, that would be discussed as part of budget workshops. What House Bill 236 does is require us to essentially provide an impact statement at the same time we present the tentative budget to council. And that impact statement's got to include the amount of the increase, the percent of the increase, and the impact to the residences and, of course, commercial businesses. So what the state's trying to do is have cities essentially provide that information when the budget process starts and not during the actual process.
Okay, and as you mentioned, the budget does include much smaller funds for the water and sewer. So this infrastructure replacement project is finished?
It is finished. Mm-hmm. It was a four-year project, and it finished last October.
Okay. Let's see, the City Council also has two budget workshops scheduled this week. So what happens at those meetings, and when and where are those?
We actually have three budget workshops meeting. The first is Wednesday, 6 o'clock at the council chambers. The second one is Friday, 6 p.m. in the council chambers. And if a third one is needed, it's Saturday morning at 8 o'clock. So we have three budget workshops set aside for reviewing the tentative budget, which will be adopted by the council at tomorrow's meeting. And then we head into the workshops to present that tentative budget to the City Council. Now, Leslie, it's really important to note that although I have included a tax increase, it doesn't mean the council is going to support that or include it in their final budget that's adopted.
Okay. Let's see, moving on, during your contract renewal process, the public learned about complaints made to the state auditor about the city's contract with the Community Alliance for Main Street, known as CAMS. Do you believe there's any merit to those complaints?
So what I do know is the complaint was filed. It had to do with me being a board member of CAMS and receiving apparently some money under the table from CAMS. No, I don't believe any of that's true. Although I am a board member, I'm a volunteer and I don't receive any compensation from CAMS. It is strictly a volunteer relationship and I've done it for 8 years. I'm also understanding that it had to do with a contract that the city has had with CAMS. We believe that there was some corrections that need to be made. We've made those. I don't believe there's an issue at this point.
Yeah. So under what circumstances can Heber City hire a contract like CAMS instead of going through the public bidding process?
There's a couple processes. One is a sole source process where we don't believe there is another firm or agency or organization that can provide the same services. There's also a provision in the city's purchasing code that allows the city manager to make the purchase if we've gone through a process of trying to identify possible organizations to provide the service. In this case, we believe it's a sole source because CAMS, who is the counterparty to this agreement, is required to provide currently 50 events per year, many of these at no cost to the public. And CAMS is also in a role of trying to advance historic development, also in a role of trying to advance the redesign and re-envision of the downtown. And I'm not aware of any organization that has the expertise or that ability to do that.
Yeah, so when the unofficial bids from the Historic Park City Alliance and Silly Sunday organizers came in much higher than the $40,000 that CAMS had quoted, is that enough then for you to make this sole source or unilateral decision?
So we didn't use those two pieces of information for making the sole source determination. That was just reaching out and just kicking tires to see what else was going on. And those two organizations you mentioned, of course, have a long track record in Park City of doing these things. And what it confirms is that the contract we have, CAMS, is very much in the city's favor in terms of what we're charging for the benefit we're getting. And we believe it's a good arrangement, not just for the city, but for the downtown.
Now, in Park City, our city manager, I believe, is authorized to approve contracts without council consent up to $50,000. Do you have similar authority?
I do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, is that the amount there, about that 50 grand?
Yeah, so the amount of this contract is 39.9, so it's just under 40,000.
Yeah. Okay, and then how long are you anticipating the auditor's review will take?
I have no idea. I'm not sure what the findings will be. I'm not sure how long it'll take. That's information I'm not privy to.
All right. Any idea what the possible outcomes may be?
I think the outcomes might be a correction, but we've already made the correction. And so I don't believe that it would be much of an outcome.
All right, moving on, the council plans to spend a couple hours on Tuesday reviewing survey results and design plans for the Main Street Park. What are some of the big takeaways from the survey?
We're going to find out Tuesday. TerraCon spent the months of February and March having three open houses and receiving surveys from the public. I believe the last count was well over 400 surveys. And they're going to present those surveys and the findings that are within them so that council has the ability to determine what the design of the plaza will be. And of course, that design is going to be based upon the input we received over the last 2 months.
All right. Will the council be adopting a final design for the park Tuesday night? And if so, what does it include?
I don't think they'll adopt a design Tuesday night. I think what they'll do is probably signal which of the three designs they most support. I suspect that will be based upon the impact or the input that we get from the public. I do suspect that at the next council meeting in May, they'll finalize that design and probably authorize TerraCon to move forward in the engineering and construction design of that design.
Okay. And how much will the park plan cost to implement, and where does that money come from?
I have included in the tentative budget $400,000 to continue the design work for phase two. That comes from two of the city's 27 funds. The first is the TAP tax fund, and the second is the park impact fee fund.
Okay. Let's see, another downtown park news. The city will try allowing dogs in the park for one day, 2 hours only, if the event is a success. I mean, will the council consider amending city code?
Yeah, so the item on the agenda is to essentially amend the code for 2 hours to allow this event at the Main Street Park based on that intel that will influence, I believe, the recommendations that the subcommittee is working on and will present to council sometime in late May or early June. And so, yeah, the next event concerning dogs will happen at the park, and we're hoping to get some intel and feedback from the public to hopefully inform the next steps.
Yeah, so when is this happening so that people can bring their dogs?
Oh, that one, it's in May. I don't recall, Leslie, what date that is, but it is later, May. It's like the 20th or 21st.
Okay. Let's see, moving on to the airport. The city is hiring a new airport manager. How's that search going?
We got over 77 applicants. The committee is reviewing those applications as we speak. We'll try to narrow that down to the top 6, 7, or 8 applicants to begin interviews. And then that will go to the finalist and the city council. Because this is a mayor appointment with a council consent, the mayor is leading this task force. And then the final interviews will be done in conjunction with the city council, who has to consent to the mayor's nominee.
Okay, any idea when that might happen, the announcement?
I suspect it will be late May or early June.
All right. The city's also implementing a new airport bylaws review committee. Who will serve on this committee?
The committee was actually created at our previous council meeting. It has 3 airport advisory board members. It has 2 public members at large. It has 2 staff members and 2 city council members. The reason this is on the agenda tomorrow is the initial 2 public members that we identified have declined to their schedules. And so we're hoping council can identify 2 alternates to represent the public on this committee.
And why was it this committee needed?
The bylaws need a review. There's some recent state legislation that impacts conflicts of interest, and the bylaws doesn't reflect those changes yet. And so it's just an opportunity for us to review the bylaws to make sure they're compliant with state code, and of course, get a fresh review to make sure they're current, up to date, and meeting our current needs.
Okay, finally wanted to ask you, as you know, your contract renewal was not unanimous. What do you think you need to do over these next 3 years to kind of change the minds of those who lobbied against renewing your contract?
Well, it's something that is very important to me to meet the needs of my 6 bosses. And so that's what my goals are, is to continue to raise that bar of excellence, try to meet those needs and continue to steer this organization in support of the council's priorities. All local governments, council leads, staff follows. And so what I need to do is making sure that staff is fully behind the council and pulling off their priorities and their policies.
Yeah, I mean, working for one boss is hard enough. I can't imagine working for 6.
It can be challenging, but I have a great council, I have a great mayor, and I'm honored to work with them. And we've done some great things the last 8 years that I've been here, and I hope to continue working with them to achieve some more successes in the future.
Okay, Matt, anything else you wanted to mention?
Yeah, we have in Heber City, we have on May 5th, our Cinco de Mayo celebration. We have a Lucha Libre wrestling team here. We've got all sorts of authentic cuisines, and hope that the community will come out and support this again on May 5th from 5 to 8 at the park and on our Festival Street, which is on 200 South.
Okay. Matt Brower serves as city manager of Heber City. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
The cost to participate in sports for Wasatch County high schoolers is increasing. KPCW's Gavin McGuffrey has that and more from a recent school board meeting.
The fee to play football at Wasatch High School is expected to increase from $75 to $100 in the 2026-27 school year. Fees for all other sports will increase from $50 to $75. Those costs will be the same for students at the Deer Creek High School when it opens in August. Wasatch County School District's business administrator, Jason Watt, says sports participation fees have remained steady for years, but must keep up with escalating costs.
The UHSAA has made a concerted effort recently to increase ref pay, and so the school is happy to supplement that pretty significantly at this point. So this would just be a little extra in their ability to pay for that.
The fee discussion came during the Wasatch County School District's Board of Education meeting April 28th. A second conversation, along with public feedback and a vote, are expected May 26. According to the board, athletes aren't the only students that will see fee bumps. Families with students in advanced placement classes will also see a slight cost increase. Those fees rise at a regular rate to keep up with material and testing needs. School District Board Member Brianne Dedrickson says the increases are not arbitrary.
These aren't random. These fees are tied back to direct costs of the class, right? The teachers This is how much my supplies are. This is how much. So there's no fluff. This is what it costs to take the class.
The district also sets a maximum fee for student travel and is proposing an increase from $1,650 to $2,000 for any single school-related trip. The board also addressed a number of district construction projects. It approved just over $400,000 for a partial roof replacement at Wasatch High to address persistent leaking at the building. It also greenlighted $390,000 in lighting upgrades for the high school's football field. Director of Operations Sean Kelly says the project will help maintain equity at its facilities as the district prepares to open Deer Creek.
In an effort to keep all high schools similar, we ask people, administration, teachers, what type of things, projects do you need right away to make these two schools equal? That was one of the big things. Our region last year all had LED lights. That's the industry standard. That was one of the first things on the list.
During a study session ahead of its regular meeting this week, the board heard a presentation on a housing needs assessment commissioned by the district. Gavin McGough, KPCW News.
The YMCA continues to operate two summer camps in Summit County, one at Camp Roger just off the Mirror Lake Highway, another at Bill Hollow off of State Route 32, both providing wilderness experiences for Utah's youth. On the phone to tell us more, I have Kelly Gernicki, she serves as the director of the overnight camps, and Ashley Ballou, the director of Summit Camps. Good morning to both of you, ladies. Thank you.
Good morning, thank you.
Ashley, let's start with you. It sounds like the summer day camps are open for registration.
Yeah, they are. Our summers can be really, really exciting. And for families, it can definitely feel like a lot to manage. And parents are trying to balance work, childcare, schedules, screen time, transportation, and wanting their kids to have a summer that actually feels active and meaningful. And that's where the Y can really support our families. And we have day camp options in Park City Monday through Friday for kids who need structure, friendship, activity, and dependable care during the day. And for families whose kids are ready for a bigger outdoor experience, we also have overnight camp and excursion options.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about the day camp here in Park City. Where is that day camp?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's at Trailside Elementary, and it starts on June 8th and runs until August 7th. So it's running throughout pretty much the entire summer.
All right, and the hours of day camp are what?
7:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m.
Okay, nice hours then. And this is for what ages?
Yeah, so we have up for kids as young as 5 years old and kids up to 12 years old. So, and we do separate out into groups. It's a pretty wide range of kids that we're working with, but we want to make sure that, you know, they're getting an experience that they're really going to enjoy.
Okay. Can you tell us about some of the activities they'll be participating in?
Of course, yeah. We do, it's really built around the needs of the families. Parents need something safe, dependable, and well-run, but kids need something that feels fun, active, and social. So we really try to bring those things together. Traditional camp gives kids a classic Y camp experience during the day. There's games, crafts, group activities, weekly themes, friendship building, and a lot of opportunities to feel part of a camp community. And for parents, it's the peace of mind that matters. They know their child is supervised, engaged, and part of a structured structured program. So for kids, it still feels like summer, not school, and it's not just childcare, but a place where they really belong.
Right. So do they have any indoor space?
Yeah, so since we're at Trailside Elementary, we have a handful of the day that we'll spend indoors, and then we do go off-site regularly. So once a week, we go swimming, we do field trips, we also visit one of our overnight camps, Camp Roger, once a week. And for our adventure camp, they actually go off-site every single day.
Oh, wow. Okay. Let's see, the cost of the camps are how much?
So for cost, we really want people to reach out to us and talk through their situation, because we, as a nonprofit, we work really hard to make sure that we're accessible to our families. We have an entire crew of staff who are there to work with our families to make sure that it's accessible to everybody.
Okay, so financial assistance is available then?
Mm-hmm. Yep, definitely.
Yeah, where would people go to look at the registration or just to find out a little bit more information?
Yeah, so if they visit ymcautah.org, they can register. They can also contact the Y, and we can kind of go through the different options to help you choose the right program, and we can even help you get registered if you're struggling with that at all.
Okay, and what's that website?
ymcautah.org.
Okay. Callie, you're in charge of the overnight camps. Is registration also underway for those?
Yes, registration is open. And Leslie, some of our sessions are already filling. So if families are interested in securing a week that works really great for them, we do recommend hopping on our website soon to get signed up.
Okay. And then these are taking place when?
When? So our first session for Mill Hollow will be June 21st, and Camp Roger is going to start 2 weeks before that, so at the very start of June.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about the difference between the camps at Mill Hollow and Camp Rogers?
Absolutely. So it's important to note that both camps are founded in the same YMCA values, safety protocols, and policies to make sure we're consistent across those fronts. From there, Camp Rogers is a little bit of a bigger camp. They have programs like horseback riding. They have a really fun spaghetti night. And overall, they're going to be doing all of your classic camp activities like archery, arts and crafts. You can find a lot of those same activities at Mill Hollow as well. But Mill Hollow has a really fun canoeing program. And it's also where we house our backcountry excursions as well.
Okay. So what does overnight camp look like? I mean, does it go like Saturday to Saturday or how does it work?
Absolutely. So our traditional programs go Sunday through Friday. We also have some shorter programs for kids who are maybe new to camp. Mini camp is only 3 nights, and our little millies are just 1 night for those kiddos who are really becoming introduced to overnight camp. The kiddos arrive Sunday afternoon. We get checked in. We catch them up on speed about what camp's about, and then they get to spend the rest of the week doing some really fun, intentional morning programs like we have a ninja school at Mill Hollow. I know Roger does like a circus session. So those are really fun and just new things to do with the kids. And then the rest of the week, they're also playing themed activities, going to campfires, having some time at the reservoir. And then Friday afternoon, we have a really fun closing ceremony. The kids get awarded for their different core values that they've shown during the week. And then they get to head on home.
All right. And between the two locations, how many sessions of overnight camps do you have?
Absolutely. Mill Hollow is going to have 7 sessions this summer, and Camp Roger will have 10.
Okay. And then how many kids per session? Any idea about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Camp Roger can have about 150 kids, while Mill Hollow has 100.
All right. And are they co-ed?
Yes, so we are co-ed camps, and then we separate the cabins within the binary, female and male, so parents can sign up their kiddos for which cabin they're comfortable in.
Mm-hmm. And what safety measures are in place at these overnight camps in terms of, I mean, you're out in the middle of nowhere pretty much.
Absolutely. That's a great question. It all starts with our staff. So we have a really rigorous hiring process, multiple interviews, background checks, and then multiple weeks of training. We have an emergency procedure for everything you could possibly think of, and we run those with our staff until we get them absolutely right. Every week, we also practice the fire drill with the kids, which is very similar to school when you practice those drills, just so everybody knows what's going on. We make sure to have satellite-capable devices at both camps as well. So while we have Wi-Fi, just in case there was ever an outage, we also have satellite to depend on as well. All of our staff are first aid CPR trained, and a couple of our staff are wilderness first aid trained. We have a volunteer nurse on site, and a few of our staff are also EMTs as well.
Okay. And again, overnight camp is for ages what?
Yeah, we start at 5 years old and we go all the way through 17.
All right. And the 1 night, that's usually for geared towards the, what, 5 to 8 years olds or something? Or
absolutely. Those are for 5 to 7 year olds.
5 to 7. Okay. All right. I know that you were working on a capital budget to make a bunch of improvements. Can you tell us about some of the improvements that families will see this summer?
Absolutely. So just recently, we finished up a brand new bathhouse at Camp Rogers. So it is wonderful. It's very comfortable for our campers now, which is very important. Looking forward at Camp Roger, we're going to start renovating the inside of our cabins to improve the ventilation, the privacy, and the overall comfort of those areas. At Mulholo, this is going to be our second summer in our brand new bathhouse, which is also amazing. It's immaculate for a camp bathroom, I can't lie. And we just finished up two more cabins. We're going to work on two more cabins this summer, as well as a brand new health center as well. So we're really trying to invest in our camps so that they stay really amazing, comfortable, and safe for generations to come.
Yeah. And again, you would offer scholarships to overnight campers as well?
Absolutely. My priority is getting as many camps as possible this summer. So if it doesn't feel possible, we really want families to reach out first so that we can meet them where they're at.
Okay. Let's see. Anything else that you want to mention about the day camps or overnight camps?
No? Yeah. I can just say, like, with our day camps, we really just want our campers to leave feeling like they belong and that they made a friend and tried something new and come home proud of themselves. It's so important right now, especially to get our kids engaged with other kids and, you know, actually off of their couches and off their screens. So we're really excited to be able to do that in Park City.
Okay. Is it ever going to change? I mean, right, we know that YMCA stands for Young Men's Christian Association, but yet you open it to females and non-Christians, yeah?
Absolutely. Yes. So camp is a place for everyone and anyone to come. The YMCA has also been branding more towards just being the Y. So while we're founded on those Christian values, we really are a space where anyone can feel welcome, and we're really intentional about making those safe spaces.
Okay. Callie Gernicki and Ashley Ballou, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Well, the Summit County attorney says that her office is investigating Wasatch County Sheriff Jared Rigby for felony obstruction of justice. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports that Rigby says he acted within the law.
Summit County Attorney Margaret Olson says the investigation stems from Rigby's alleged conduct ahead of the Corey Richens murder trial. Attorneys who represent parties in the case say the alleged conduct is also related to the upcoming Republican primary election for Wasatch County Sheriff. One of Rigby's two challengers is Summit County Detective Eric Maynard, a lead investigator in the Richens case. The Summit County Attorney's Office says it received an anonymous letter in the mail with, quote, potential implications for the trial, which was 1 month away. It's unclear exactly what the letter says, but the attorney's office says it has a duty to investigate. Rick Van Wagner is Maynard's attorney.
I understand there's an active investigation on whether an anonymous letter was extortion or blackmail to get Eric out of the election, and when that didn't work, an effort to sully him as a potential witness in a murder case with false statements about him. If any of that is true, that could be a serious crime by whoever was behind the anonymous letter.
Rigby, who is seeking a third term as sheriff, says he acted lawfully. He also pointed to the upcoming election as the reason for the controversy. He says the complaints against him are politically motivated and called for a, quote, immediate investigation by a law enforcement agency that is neutral, unbiased, and free of legal conflict. Olson says Rigby asked 3rd District Judge Richard Mrozek to disqualify the Summit County Attorney's Office from the case, but was denied after a hearing. No charges against Rigby had been filed as of early Friday afternoon. Rigby, Maynard, and another Republican, Jeremy Hales, will face off in the primary election June 23rd. No Democrats are seeking the sheriff's post. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Top of Maine, formerly Wasatch Brew Pub, is closing for good after a 37-year run in Park City. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports the restaurant and bar was the first brew pub in Utah.
Building owner Greg Scherf tells KPCW the original Wasatch Brew Pub is under contract to be sold to a New York investor as of Tuesday. The deal will close within 60 days. Scherf declined to disclose the name of the buyer or purchase price. According to employees of Scherf's tenant, known as Top of Maine since 2023, the new owners bought out and terminated their lease. The business and all its equipment has to be moved by the end of July, Scherf says. Top of Maine will still produce beer for a short time before then.
And, you know, it was fun, but everything runs its course. And of course, the beer industry changed monumentally.
The 73-year-old Scherf sold his stake in Wasatch Brewery, which merged with Squatters Craft Beer in 2000, more than a decade ago. Top of Maine was his last real estate connection to the beer business. Scherf isn't sure what the new owners will do with the place. He founded Wasatch Brewery in 1986 in Park City's Iron Horse District. Wasatch Brew Pub opened in 1989. It will be the second Main Street institution departing this year. Main Street Pizza and Noodle closed April 5th after a 35-year run, citing rising rent. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.